Here's a little song. Yeah, this is from the perspective of the snake in the Garden of Eden from the musical Apple Tree. Listen closely. Let me fill you in about the rich white round bread. Rosy apple they call forbidden fruit. So promise you'll be mute. Because at every return, the thorn and thorns, they'll come around like hungry buffaloes. And in no time, there'll be none of those precious apples left for you and me. Now in the average apple, you're accustomed to skin, seeds, flesh, and core. But you will find that these are special apples that will give you something more.
From the New Revised Standard Version, updated edition. Hear now these words. Then God said, "Let us make humans in our image, according to our likeness, and let them have dominion over the fish of the sea, and over the birds of the air, and the cattle, and over all the wild animals of the earth, and over every creeping thing that creeps upon the earth." So God created the humans in God's image. In the image of God, He created them. Male and female, He created them. God saw everything that He made. And indeed, it was very good. And there was evening, and there was morning, the sixth day. I'd also like to read an excerpt from the Reverend Dr. Miguel de la Torre's book. If you are not familiar with him, if you're interested in progressive theology, liberation theology, I highly encourage you to go find and read, maybe even start with this book, Doing Christian Ethics from the Margins. And in that book, he has this to say. Those in power have always used theology to maintain their control, declaring who is sinful, who is saved, who is worthy. Original sin was not simply a doctrine. It was a tool. It convinced people that they were born broken, so they would never question the system that held them down. But when we begin theology from the underside, from the margins, we hear a different story. A story where worth is not earned, but assumed, where grace is not rationed, but abundant, where the divine is not found in guilt, but found in the struggle for dignity.
Here's a song by the Pet Shop Boys from the 80s.
Series, and it's called The Sacred Undoing. And today's message is entitled Original Sin Ain't Original. Let's start this sacred undoing with one of the greatest theological guilt trips of all time, the doctrine of original sin. You know the one, we all know the one. According to traditional Christian teaching, you were born already broken. Not just flawed or imperfect, but downright sinful. A cosmic screw up before you even had a chance to steal a cookie or talk back to your mom. You inherited a moral debt just for being human. And thanks to two naked folks in a fruit tree in the ancient Middle East, you've been carrying the weight of that shame ever since. Just about sounds like a spiritual pyramid scheme, doesn't it? That the doctrine of original sin has been around for a long time, and at least since Augustine in the 4th century. He's sort of the one who really sort of turbocharged the idea that all of humanity inherited from Adam and Eve disobedience in the garden. And let's be clear, he didn't come to that conclusion by accident. Augustine had his own baggage, lots of it actually. He wrote extensively about his struggles with lust and desire and control. The dude practically invented the concept of having hang-ups. So, when he read the Genesis story, he didn't just see a myth about human freedom and divine boundaries. So a cautionary tale about sex and shame and the eternal consequences of letting your bodies do what bodies actually do. So from there, he stitches together a sort of theological masterpiece of guilt that has haunted Christian theology ever since. See, but from that point forward, original sin became a staple of Western Christianity. It was a theological power move. If everyone is born sinful, then someone needs the church to save them. Neat, tidy, profitable. It's the spiritual equivalent of a problem and solution sales pitch. You know, but you're doomed. Like with you, I got just what you need. And y'all, we've all bought it with blind sinker. Guilt-soaked sinker. We baptized it, we catechized it, we enshrined it in dusty old doctrine and waved it like a flag over anyone bold enough to try to question it. We built entire systems on it. Systems that have more to do with control than they ever had to do with compassion. Alright, so here's the doctrine in its class. Four. Human beings are born into a state of sin inherited from Adam and Eve. Now, because of their disobedience, all people are separated from God at birth. Even newborn babies are in need of salvation. And the only cure is divine intervention, usually through baptism and or the belief in the sacrificial death of Jesus, which we'll be getting to next week. So in short, you are a sinner by nature, not by choice. You cannot not be sinful. It's baked into your DNA. You don't even get to decide to opt in on sin. It's in your default settings. The idea shows up in Sunday schools and summer camps and Christian cartoons. It shows up in purity culture and in Bible tracts and in judgmental comments from that one elder of the church who always has a little too much to say about skirts that fall just above the knee. But if we're being honest, it's not just theology. It's spiritual architecture. It's worldview. It shapes how we see ourselves, how we treat others, and what we believe about what's even possible in this world. See, this dogma, it teaches that your soul enters the world already stained, already guilty, already deserving of punishment. There's no ancient innocence, no benefit of the doubt. You're just born under judgment. And the only thing that can fix it is divine intervention, mediated through the proper theological channels, of course. Is why baptism often is seen as a requirement rather than a celebration. It's why altar calls exist. It's why so many churches emphasize personal conversion experiences with a heavy, heavy focus on admitting your guilt, pleading for your forgiveness, often before you even understand what you're being forgiven for. And it's not just the church. It's capitalism, it's marketing, it's everything. Everything that whispers, you are not enough. It's every sermon that equates struggle with spiritual failure. It's every institution that benefits from your self-doubt. Let's tell the truth. If your theology starts with the belief that people are inherently bad, then everything you build from there is going to carry that same broken language and logic. Control, punishment, exclusion, manipulation. And then what? You teach people that grace is something they have to earn? That love is something they have to beg for? That salvation is a product and the church is its only authorized dealer? Wow. I mean, y'all, if that doesn't smell like spiritual snake oil, I don't know what does. And here's the thing. If you start from guilt, you'll never arrive at joy. If you start from condemnation, you always will struggle to believe in compassion. A bad premise leads to a bad conclusion. And this one has had centuries to fester. Let's say the quiet part out loud. Jesus did not teach this doctrine. Not once. Not ever. Jesus talked about forgiveness, yes. About justice, liberation, pardon, and healing. And yes, he talked about sin. But he never suggested that people were born spiritually defective. Never said that babies needed salvation. Never told parents to fear their own children for their own children's souls. Never equated your DNA with your damnation. In fact, when Jesus talks about children, he actually lifts them up as a model of faith. He doesn't say these simple little creatures need saving. He says the kingdom belongs to them. He doesn't start with condemnation. He starts with compassion. And that's not a footnote. That's the whole message. So the idea of inherited guilt. Well, that came later. Augustine took the mythic, metaphorical poetry of Genesis and read into it his own, sexual hang-ups. Then Anselm and later Calvin took that guilt and they sort of cooked it all down into this thought of as transactional theology. And essentially, God is angry. God is an angry God. Blood must be shed. So, sign right here and say your prayer before the rapture hits. Again, more on the blood must be shed part next week. But scholars have been calling this out for decades. Elaine Pagels, James Barr, Walter Brueggemann, who sadly passed away a few days ago, they've all lifted up the text of Genesis for what it is, a story about freedom and responsibility. Not about original failure. A story about consequences, not about condemnation. And let me say this plain. If your theology tells you that you are unlovable from birth, it's not love that you're worshiping, it's power. When Jesus did talk about what he really did live, it was love, it was grace, it was invitation, it was healing. He didn't build up a system of worthiness requirements. He built a table long enough for everybody to sit at. Jesus practiced radical inclusion, not inherited shame. He looked people in the eye and he said, you belong. Not, you're broken, here's a deal. One of the most toxic legacies of original sin, of that theology, is how blame has been disproportionately placed on Eve. For centuries, Christian interpretation of Genesis has cast Eve as the one who led Adam astray, the one who opened the floodgates of sin. That misogynistic framing has had devastating effects. Not just in pulpits, not just in policies, but in households and entire cultures. Women have been portrayed as spiritually weaker, morally suspect, and dangerously seductive. But the narrative has fueled everything from purity culture to witch hunts to the exclusion of women in leadership in churches. It's not just bad theology. It's violent theology. It turns myth into misogyny. And it still echoes today. And that power, the power that comes from convincing people that they are born with sin, it causes harm. Original sin theology teaches us to distrust our own bodies, to second guess our instincts, to believe our minds are corrupted and our desires are suspect. It teaches our children that they are bad. It teaches adults that their joy is dangerous. It teaches entire communities that shame is holy. It teaches us that pain is punishment, that mental illness is weakness, that suffering is deserved. It keeps people quiet in abusive relationships, telling them to pray harder instead of run faster. It tells queer folks that they are broken. It tells women that their bodies are temptation. To tell survivors their trauma is just another thing to repent for. It silences questions. It excommunicates doubt. It punishes curiosity. And churches that build their foundations on it often become obsessed with behavior and purity and appearances, while justice and liberation and honesty just get shoved over the shadows. This week we are grieving another horror, the murder of two Wisconsin elected officials, allegedly by a suspect who at least went to church or may be a minister. Early reports suggest that this was politically motivated, underscoring exactly how extremist Christian nationalism beliefs can twist faith into violence. When doctors like the original sin are weaponized, portray particular people as spiritually inferior or essentially threats, it's no theological leap for some people to believe that that divine charge gives license for real world harm. We must name this risk and refuse silence when a distorted divine blessing is used as justification for brutality. This theology that they practice, it doesn't create disciples, it creates dependents, people who are afraid to grow, people who are afraid to speak, afraid to be, people who show up to church week after week, it's funny and sad at the same time, hoping that they can finally hate themselves just the right amount to be loved by God. That's not faith. That's spiritual abuse in a choir room. And the saddest part is that many folks never even know that it's happening. They don't. They think that heavy, anxious weight is just sort of part of being Christian. That discomfort is a sign of piety. That dread is devotion. But that's not how love moves. That's not how love works. That's not how freedom works. Y'all, love also doesn't gaslight. Love liberates. So the long-term damage, this generational, this communal, it turns entire congregations into guilt factories and calls it faithfulness. But Jesus said, "Come to me, all of you who are weary and burdened, and I will give you rest." Original sin does not offer rest. Just piles on more burdens. And the ripple effect, it stretches far. When people are taught that salvation is about escaping a broken world, they believe it. They will stop believing you can even heal that world. When you frame yourself as inherently bad, you start to see your neighbor in the same way. You build walls, not bridges. You create hierarchies of worth instead of communities of grace. And this theology, it has hands. It votes. It legislates. It shows up in policies that punish rather than restore. It teaches churches to protect institutions over individuals. It trains us to see the vulnerable as spiritual, suspicious instead of divinely loved. That's not just bad theology, that's bad humanity. But what if we were to start somewhere else? Let's go back to Genesis. Not the snake, not the tree, the beginning. The real beginning. But God created a human in God's image, it was good beginning. That right there, that's your foundation. That's the root. That's the truth. You were made in the image of love. You are not born guilty. You are not born broken. You are born beloved. What if instead of original sin, we talked about, thought about, practiced original blessing? What if instead of inherited guilt, we talk about inherited sacredness? Imagine what should change if every child grew up hearing, "You are a gift to this world. You are good. You are worthy of love. And not just someday, right here, right now." I mean, imagine if our theology didn't begin with, "You are broken," but with, "You are a wonder." That doesn't mean, I'm not saying, it doesn't mean that we ignore harm. It means that we respond to harm from a place of dignity. We don't confess because we're garbage. If we even feel the need to confess, it's because we know that we are worth healing. That's the shift. That's the sacred undoing. Let go of the shame-based scaffolding. Let's preach a faith that builds people up instead of breaks people down. Let's trade the guilt trip for a justice journey. And speaking of justice journeys, did you see the No Kings protest yesterday? Reportedly, the largest public protest against a sitting president in U.S. history. At this point, as of this morning, less than an hour ago, reportedly over 12 million people participated. That's not just noise, that's power. A political scientist, Erica Chinoweth, her research shows that when just 3.5% of the population engages in sustained nonviolent protest, no government in the history of the world has been able to keep its grip on power. So when people flood the streets with signs that say "No Kings," they're not just protesting a president. They're embodying a gospel of truth. No one has the right to rule over others in the name of divine authority. Not the White House, not the church, not in our hearts. Because if we believe in the original blessing, not the original sin, And we also believe in collective resistance to systems that deny that original blessing. So let's bury original sin once and for all. Let's restart with blessing and move towards a beloved community. Because, folks, I'm here to tell you, you were never a mistake. You were not. You are in the image of love. And that, my friends, is a pretty damn good place to start. So, may we teach our children that they are good. May we unlearn what shame has built. May we reclaim the truth that love was here long before guilt, and that it will still be here long after. And may we walk into the world like people who know that they are already enough. Already.
Saying it's not over, and my heart starts to beat so loud.
loud now, drowning out the doubt. I'm down, but I'm not out. There's a worry, guilt, and peace, and they're fighting for my sacred space. But I'm living
space not to confess our failure, but to remember our original lesson. May we unlearn the lies that told us we were broken from the beginning. Undo the weight of inherited guilt, the fear that we're never enough, and live from outlooks of love, not outlooks of lacking. May we reclaim the creation story, not as one of condemnation, but of connection to each other, to the earth, to the divine. We remember today, too, that it is Father's Day. We honor all who father in love. Those who raise children with tenderness, who nurture communities with care, who protect, support, and show up. And we hold gently the grief of those for whom this day carries ache or absence. May this be a day of healing, of truth-telling, of remembering who we really are, fearfully, wonderfully, and unapologetically made in love's image. May we walk from this place with lighter shoulders and braver hearts, ready to build a world where worthiness is not a prize, but a birthright. Amen. Receive this blessing. May you walk in harmony with each other and with creation, recognizing that we are one. And may you know love and happiness throughout your life. May your words and your actions share that love and happiness with all of those you meet. Thank you.